Hello, listeners, and welcome. This is Michelle Gonsman of Gonsman Group Legal Nurse Consulting. I want to welcome you to one of our very first InfoCast series. This is the Nursing Process and Critical Thinking. Today is the Assessment InfoCast. I wanted to start with this because it's so important and critical, the understanding of the nursing process and critical thinking when we're doing a review for nursing negligence, and we will talk about physician, nurse practitioner, PA provider negligence in general, but I wanted to start with this particular InfoCast. As we proceed, past InfoCasts will be available. So if you're listening to one on the pressure ulcer series and you want to hear the assessment, this particular InfoCast, always go back to my website, gonsmangroupllnc.com, and you can get any past webcast or, InfoCast that is in there. So you understand why I'm doing this. What we do at Gonsman Group is we help you, the attorney, interpret the medical record. We help evaluate the medical record, look for adherences to the standard of care or deviations from the standard of care. And sometimes it's not always black and white. You just can't say, well, X, Y, Z, this. There's always an interpretive eye that we need to use. And again, I wanted to reiterate why I'm using this, the nursing process, as the first one. I want to read a quote very quickly from the American Nurses Association. The standards of practice describe a competent level of nursing care as demonstrated by the critical thinking model known as the nursing process. The standards of practice coincide with the steps of the nursing process and represent the directive nature of the standards as the professional nurse completes each component of the nursing process. Similarly, the standards of professional performance relate to how the professional nurse adheres to the standards of practice, completes the nursing process, and adheres to other nursing practice issues and concerns, end quote. Essentially, this process, and again, we're going to talk about the first step in this process today, is the basis for all nursing practice. Nursing practice leads to standard of care. I mean, I know everybody, this elusive, I've heard it referred to as the elusive standard of care. But when I'm reviewing cases, I think, and I work all across the country, do cases all across the country. So I know that each state has its own particular definition, expert witness designation, et cetera, et cetera. But in general, it is what a reasonable and prudent practitioner would do in the same or similar circumstance. And every reasonable practitioner would use the nursing process or nursing practitioner. And again, we're going to talk about physicians and advanced providers also. But for nurses, it is the absolute standard. It's a circular loop. And if any part of that loop is broken, it's like a chain. If the link in the chain is broken, the chain is broken. And that, again, is the reason why I wanted to start this InfoCast series with the nursing process. And I will refer back to these InfoCasts on the nursing process again and again and again. And that's why I want you to be able to go back and review any InfoCast that you need. I will let you know that now, if you're listening in your car or something, this is a little bit longer, probably one of the longer ones that you're going to listen to. I'm going to try to limit them to 15 or 20 minutes, but this is a little bit longer. But again, it is the foundation for my medical legal reviews for nursing negligence. And as I stated, physicians do go through a similar process. The steps in this process, the nursing process, assessment, diagnosing, planning/outcome identification, intervention, and evaluation. And when you hit evaluation, you just start back again at assessing. And evaluation can sometimes be called reassessing. Today, as I said, we're only going to talk about assessing. The next InfoCast will be diagnosing, planning/outcome identification, and the third InfoCast will be intervention and evaluation. So we're going to break this all up into three segments. And as I stated before, I'm looking for the nursing process. Did the nurses do what they were supposed to do? And I'm going to give you examples as we go through. And I'm also going to talk about critical thinking. I always just say, use your noggin. Use the common sense that you're supposed to have. If a patient's blood pressure is 70 over 30, do not get them up and walk them around. So, again, using common sense, but the official critical thinking, I would say, definition would be taking the data gleaned from the nursing process and applying that information and data. Basically, think. Use your common sense. Use what you have learned from your assessment, from your reassessment to take care of your patient. The nursing process can be done very rapidly and simultaneously. All the steps can sort of be congealed into one or two steps, or it can be done over a period of time. And that's where we're going to spend most of our time, is on the lengthier nursing process. But for an example, I do currently work in a level 2 trauma center. And sometimes we are very rapidly doing this nursing process. For instance, if my assessment is a patient is not breathing and has no pulse, that would be an assessment. I'm going to diagnose the patient that they are having an alteration in cardiopulmonary status. Now, am I really going to stand there and say that in my head? No. My plan would be to do CPR. Do I really stand there and think, well, I'm going to plan to do CPR? No. I rapidly assess the patient, go through steps 2 and 3, and then hit the actual intervention step where I'm doing CPR. Now, as CPR is in progress and advanced cardiac life support is in progress, the nurse would reassess the patient or reevaluate the patient. And if there's a pulse, they would change the game plan up. So that's a very, very rapid sequence of the official nursing process. But there are steps. You have to start, and it all starts with assessment. If I would fail to assess that my patient didn't have a pulse or wasn't breathing, there would be a major issue. So with that said, that's why we spend time on assessment, because it is one of the most crucial and critical parts of the nursing process. If you don't assess a patient, it all falls apart from there. All right. But we're going to spend, like I said, most of the time with the nursing process over time. You're going to hear me. I'm probably going to use some pressure ulcer examples for this when we're talking about it. But assessment, again, without this step, everything else fails. The American Nurses Association says the registered nurse collects comprehensive data pertinent to the healthcare consumer's health or situation. There are a ton of regs out there with nursing standards of practice, federal regs, state regs, and every state has their own nursing scope and standards of practice. We're all familiar with the Code of Federal Regulations, especially if you do nursing home litigation for CFR 43. But for instance, like Tennessee clearly states that registered nurses conduct and document nursing assessments of individuals and groups. Pennsylvania. Nurses, registered nurse collects complete and ongoing data to determine nursing care needs. Georgia, and they really spell it out very nicely, the standards of registered professional nursing practice delineate the quality of nursing care which a patient / client should receive regardless of whether it is provided by a registered nurse. And then they go on to talk about some delegation issues. But it says the standards are based on the premise that the registered nurse is responsible for and accountable to the patient for the quality of care rendered. The registered nurse shall assess the patient in a systemic, organized manner. So it's very well spelled out. And I referenced CFR 483. That is for long-term care facilities from the Code of Federal Regulations. Resident assessment 43.20. The facility must conduct initially and periodically a comprehensive, accurate, standardized, reproducible assessment of each resident's functional capacity. So as you can see, there's many, many, many laws on the books regarding assessment. There's also many types of assessments. And somebody says, well, how do you know which one to do? Well, let's talk about your complete assessment. This is a head-to-toe or comprehensive assessment. This is most often seen as an admission assessment. Or in a physician's office, this would be more like the initial visit. You get a past medical history, a social history, a family history, a spiritual history. You're basically treating the whole patient. You're not just treating that cough on their initial visit they come in for. You need to get a whole history. It's a comprehensive assessment. Excuse me. Then there's a focused assessment. This would be someone who comes into the ER with a broken toe. If I see that someone's toe is all wonky, for lack of that's my very technical term, wonky. If I know their toe's broken and that's why they're there, I'm not going to be testing all of their cranial nerves. And we'll talk about some other things that we won't be doing. It's a very focused assessment. You know, of course, making sure they're okay, but I'm going to check that toe. I'm going to check that foot, make sure it can move. Does it have sensation? Does it have capillary refill? Does it have circulation? That's a focused assessment. You're focusing on one body system. Then there's a shift assessment, and this is a lot of times when you're in a hospital or a long-term care facility, when one shift is leaving, passing on care to another shift, and the nurse will go in, the oncoming nurse goes in and assesses her patients. This is a more concise assessment. They're probably not going to be reassessing the spiritual aspect of the patient or the family history or anything like that. They're probably going to do a head-to-toe assessment, but not do all of the, I call it extraneous, complete admission assessment details. Physicians basically have the same type of assessments. They always break, it's called a history and physical. They break it into a history, history of present illness, history of past medical and surgical history, medicine history, social history. They do the same things. They just break it out into history, and then they have the physical examination part, and then they have impressions and plans, etc. The assessment sometimes can be difficult to understand now because of the electronic medical record. Now, again, there will be an entire series on the electronic medical record. It will be coming up. I promise you, I'm in the midst of finalizing it now. People say, don't do the nursing process, do this one first. But I truly think that you have to understand the nursing process to understand how to review this electronic medical record. Unfortunately, sometimes in the electronic medical record, and you're going to hear me say EMR. So when I say EMR, I mean the electronic record. Some people call it the EHR, electronic health record. There's a difference. I will explain it in that series. But for today, EMR, we're just talking about those electronic records where you get, I think one case I had 70,000 pages, another one 35,000 pages. They just print enormously, okay? But however, when I'm reviewing an EMR, nurses can click within normal limits. Point and click. You know, they try to make it easier and it is safer for patients, but they're pointing and clicking. And they might be reviewing the HENT system. Head, eyes, ears, nose, and throat. And they might click within normal limits, all right? And Cerner and Meditech, these are two of the big guns out there. They actually will have what normals are. For instance, in Meditech, at the end of the hundreds and hundreds of printed nurses' notes are the normals. It will say, if a nurse has clicked normal for gastrointestinal system, this is what our normals are. Abdomen is soft, abdomen is flat, is not distended, abdomen has normal bowel sounds, etc. All right? So think about if a nurse clicks within normal limits for the gastrointestinal system, but the patient actually doesn't have any bowel sounds, their abdomen's distended because they've perforated. That could be a problem for the patient and the practitioner, especially if that's the reason we as attorneys are reviewing the records. We are either the plaintiff or the defense attorney. It could be a problem if that nurse says the gastrointestinal system was within normal limits because they simply were in a hurry, or they actually just didn't assess it, or they just wanted to click within normal limits, or it was a misclick. And there are misclicks out there, and we'll talk about those in the EMR series. But anyway, you can see how sometimes within normal limits does not mean it truly, truly was. For instance, Cerner, and I use Cerner in my own practice. One of the normal for the head, eyes, ears, nose, and throat system, it includes nares patent. Now, I've been a nurse for over 22 years, and I can count on my hand how many times in all those 22 years and all those thousands of hours of working with patients that I have actually looked up somebody's nose. Now, if a three-year-old comes in and their mom says they shove some light bright bulbs up their nose, of course, I'm going to look up their nose, or I may defer to the doctor because I don't want to upset the little guy too much. But nurses routinely do not look up people's noses unless you work in an ENT physician's office or something like that. But in general, in a hospital, in the Cerner system, and believe me, I'm not knocking any of these EMR systems. I'm just saying in this particular system, the normal, if you click it, you're saying the nares are patent. And how do you know they're patent unless you've looked up their nose? So you see sometimes nurses are clicking and clicking, and physicians may be doing the same thing and clicking within normal when they're not meeting all of the normal requirements. So I do like to point that out, because a savvy plaintiff attorney is going to come in and say, well, Nurse Jones, you know, you clicked within normal limits. Did you look up their nose? And the same for physicians and a defense attorney. You don't want to be blindsided with that. You want to make sure you understand that and know that that is one of the normals, and you know, prep your patient, or excuse me, not your patient, your client. And sometimes this seemingly harmless click, it can be false documentation. And again, we talked about, especially if that's the body system involved in litigation. Okay. I want to talk very briefly about scribes, and I'm just going to mention this. We can have a whole podcast on, or excuse me, infocast on this if we want to. There are scribes out there. Physicians are using them to help them with documentation, make their documentation faster. They're usually med students or PA students or nurse practitioner students, someone that literally follows the doctor around and documents what the doctor says. Okay. And if the doctor is in with a stroke patient, for instance, and the scribe has now clicked within normal limits, okay, is the neuro system really within normal limits? Did that scribe misclick, or did that doctor just not assess the neurological status in in a stroke patient. I would hope that's not the case, you know, and the scribe misclicked, but it can be very difficult. So if we have a case they're using scribes, we have to be very careful to know that we're using scribes and really look at that documentation. Another piece of assessment, and this is so often where I see so many missteps, we'll just call them missteps, vital signs. Vital signs are an assessment of the patient, part of the assessment, critical part. If in my daily practice, in my practice, if somebody says, hey, this patient doesn't look good, or they're dizzy or something, one of the first things I'm going to ask for or get myself are, what are their vital signs? What's their blood pressure? What's their pulse? What is this doing? There is a caveat out there, treat the patient, not the numbers, but you have to know what the numbers are. So basically, blood pressure, pulse, respirations, temperature, and pain is noted as the fifth vital sign. And I always throw in an oxygen level as an additional vital sign. For instance, if a patient is having a respiratory issue, there should be an oxygen level recorded in addition to all of the other vital signs. Okay. And vital signs are frequently where I see, like I said, so many missteps. If a patient, and this is where the assessment comes in. Blood pressure might be 70 over 43. They've properly assessed that patient. But as we hit the other infocast and learn the rest of the steps, I want to know what did that nurse or that provider do about that blood pressure. That's what we're looking at. So sometimes the assessment is fine. Yes, they assessed that patient. They assessed that set of vital signs. But what did they do? All right. And a lot of times I have so many attorneys saying, well, how frequently should vital signs be done? What was the standard of care for this? Honestly, each facility is going to have their own policies. I mean, in general, you're going to see vital signs in a quote-unquote stable patient. And we're going to talk, I have a feeling I'm going to have a whole infocast on what is a stable patient. But in a stable patient in ICU, they should be every hour. A person receiving blood products gets more frequent vital signs. The caveat here in the take-home message would be follow the facility policy. Or if a doctor orders every 2-hour vital signs, I would expect them to be done every 2 hours following the doctor's order. But it doesn't mean you can't do them every hour or every half hour. It's within a nursing scope of practice to go ahead and do vital signs as often as needed. So the frequency is by facility policy, by physician order, and when they are needed, if there's a problem, if there's a change in patient, if you're administering a medication that's going to affect the blood pressure and pulse, I would expect to see at least a blood pressure and pulse documented, at least, okay? For instance, during breathing treatments, you're going to see pulses recorded because sometimes the albuterol can increase the pulse. So it is very patient dependent, but as often as needed, when there's a change in patient condition, per facility policy and by physician order. If a physician, like I said, and just to hit that point home, if the physician orders every 2-hour vital signs, they must be done at least every 2 hours, but can be done more frequently according to nursing judgment. And again, it is within the scope of practice. Failure to assess vital signs can be very detrimental to a patient. Another type of assessment are risk assessments, okay? And we deal a lot with risk assessments in nursing, physician and PA and nurse practitioner practice. And I deal a lot with reviewing risk assessments. Okay. There are many, many, many risk assessments, fall risk. And we will, I promise, have a whole series on falls, and we will go in depth, get down and dirty reviewing these risk assessments for falls. Same for pressure ulcers. We're going to have a whole entire series on pressure ulcers. And I have a feeling there might be some very good interviews that I'll put out there too with some different people with pressure ulcers, but we will get down and dirty with the pressure ulcer risk scores. There's an elopement risk, an incontinence risk. Those are more for long-term care facilities. There are abuse and suicide screenings, depression screenings. In physician's office, there are screenings and risk scores for colon cancer, breast cancer. Do they have a blood clot in their lungs, a pulmonary embolism? There are always risk assessments. And the thing with these, no matter what risk you're assessing, the toll is usually picked by the facility, or it is dependent on the electronic medical record provider, the software company. Okay, they might say, well, we use the Norton scale, or we use the Morse scale for fall risk, and this is what's in our computer system. Doesn't matter what they're using. It has to be valid. Does it test what it's supposed to test? And there's inter-rater reliability. Can nurse A and nurse B get the same information, the same score, with the same patient at the same time? And as medical legal reviewers, what I do is I always look and say, did they do it correctly? If I'm reading documentation, if I'm getting a picture in my head, and honestly, I get visions in my head when I'm reading these charts, I can picture the patient. I can picture how they look in my head. And is the picture of a patient that I'm getting from the nursing documentation or from the physician documentation matching with that score? Okay. Is it matching? So basically, that's what we're looking for. They're supposed to be objective, but a lot of times there are missteps and incorrectly done risk scores. Okay. So for the purpose of this infocast, we're just going to speak about some in general. But the take-home message, if risk is not assessed, proper preventative and treatment measures cannot be put into place. Just as an example, if a nurse assesses that a patient is not a high fall risk, the patient will not get high fall risk prevention. And if the patient falls and fractures their leg, and the patient was truly a high fall risk and the nurse did the risk score incorrectly, therefore failing to prevent the fall, then that's where there's an issue. There's no substitute for good judgment. And also, I don't ever, ever recall reviewing a case where somebody was, there was alleged overprotection of a patient. So the risk scores I'm always seeing, did they do them correctly? Is it jiving? Are they corroborating correlating with what I'm seeing or what I'm reading actually? Another thing about these is everybody always wants to know, well, how frequently should they be done? Again, same thing with vital signs. It's facility specific. Rule of thumb is risk scores. You're going to do them upon admission. You're going to do them upon transfer to a different floor. Some might be done daily, like the pressure ulcer risk in ICU would be done daily or every shift. But again, the take-home message is with any change in condition. You know, home care, they may not do a risk assessment except every month, but they're sort of assessing the patient when they go in at every visit. So, like, again, it's specific, but the most important thing is when there's a change in condition, did they reassess the risk? Let's talk very briefly about pressure ulcer prevention. We'll use this as an example. Okay. You have Mary, the nurse, who assesses Mrs. Smith. Mrs. Smith is a 90-year-old patient who's demented. She's incontinent of bowel and bladder. She's paralyzed on her right side, cannot move herself in bed. She cannot communicate her needs, and she needs fed by staff. Mrs. Smith is essentially dependent on staff, totally dependent on staff for care. Mary improperly assesses Mrs. Smith's Braden score and gives her a score of 19. Now, in the pressure ulcer series, you'll understand that 19 is a fairly high score and a fairly low risk. The higher the score, the less the risk. So Mary, trust me, did not do the score appropriately. And unfortunately, Mrs. Smith was not placed on high-risk preventative measures, and she develops a pressure ulcer. There's where the problem. Improper assessment of the risk led to improper prevention and treatment. Now, let's look at Mrs. Smith again. And after she develops the pressure ulcer, and this is a lot of times where I'm seeing so many missteps, the nurses, she gets this pressure ulcer, and it's a stage 2. And the nurses, day in, day out, for several weeks, are documenting stage 2 pressure ulcer, 1 by 1/2 centimeter with a red wound base. Okay, they're documenting that. That's their wound assessment, day in, day out. All right. Suddenly, one day, a nurse who I haven't seen the name pop, and this happens a lot. You know, you see the same names over and over again in a chart, and then somebody pops up who hasn't taken care of Mrs. Smith yet, and I see that this pressure ulcer now is unstageable. It's 10 by 10. It's necrotic and infected. Well, what happened? And we'll get to that in a second. I mean, the nurses were assessing it, and just overnight did that happen. Now, okay, defense attorneys, I know you're chomping at the bit here. In the pressure ulcer series, we will talk about how things like that are alleged to have happened, but we're just going to talk in general right now. Of note, though, the physicians also need to be assessing that wound and what happened to the physician assessment. I can honestly tell you, and this is where you need your nurses to interpret things for you. The physician probably never looked at that wound. They relied on the nursing assessment, or they read the nursing assessment and said, oh, it's stage 2. Okay. You know, it's okay. It's not changing. So this is really what's happening. So again, how did this happen? Well, it was improperly assessed. All right, it's not going to go from a stage 2 1 to 1.5 centimeters to a 10 by 10 wound in one shift or overnight. All right, it's improper assessment. I have a sinking feeling also that it was an electronic medical record and it was copied and pasted, meaning the nurses just copied and pasted and carried forward these assessments. And you're going to understand exactly what that means and the repercussions of it in litigation when we do the electronic medical record series. However, no matter how this documentation was incorrect, each provider is responsible for their own documentation. The second they sign their name or hit enter and sign that chart, they're responsible for that documentation. Improper assessment leads to improper or lack of prevention or treatment. And to reiterate this, you have this woman who it was a documented stage two. According to a facility, their protocol said, well, when it gets to a stage three, we consult wound care. Right. So if this patient never, it was never documented that she had a stage three and only a stage two for days and days and days, wound care was never consulted. So you can see, again, how improper assessment leads to improper treatment. And if I haven't said this already, any case I'm talking about or any example I'm giving is completely out of my head, completely hypothetical. Unfortunately, all too familiar sometimes, and some cases sound like other cases, but I promise you, attorneys, especially if you're my clients, we're not talking about a specific case. These are all purely hypothetical cases, but like I said, unfortunately, sometimes the cases are all too familiar because they're repetitive. Anyway, we're going to talk very briefly about scales. This is another type of assessment. These are scales: the Glasgow Coma Scale, the NIH Scale, Pain Scale, Sedation Scale, Ramsey Scale, Aldrete Scale. There's tons and tons of scales. And each care setting is going to have different scales that they're going to use. I pretty much can tell you that a nurse in a nursing home is not, unless she worked in an acute care hospital, but nurses in nursing homes are not ever going to use an Aldrete score. The Aldrete score is something that recovery room nurses, nurses like myself who do conscious sedation, that is that type of score, okay? There's all kinds of score of scales. And like the risk tools, they have to be valid and have inter-rater reliability. I'm going to talk about one in particular in a couple minutes here. But again, with any type of scale, it's to detect a change. And it's what do the practitioners do when they detect a change? Okay, have they done it? But it all starts with, did they do the scale appropriately? Did they assess the patient? I want to talk about the Glasgow Coma Score because this is something very simply done. It can be done just by looking at a patient and having a one or two sentence conversation with the patient. Every nurse is taught this. Every provider is taught this. This is something that can be done very easily. All right. The Glasgow Coma Score. And basically what it does, it's testing neurological intactness. Like how intact is a patient? And I'm not talking cranial nerve assessment here. I'm talking like, are they deteriorating from a head bleed or what's going on here? Or how's their sensorium? So this is what this is testing. It was developed years and years and years ago for trauma. The scores range from 3 to 15. And remember, 3 to 15. 15, and the higher the score, the better. 15 would be you and I. We're alert, we're oriented, we're talking. I hope we all score a 15. excuse me. There are three subcategories. And it is important to know the baseline. That first Glasgow Coma Score assessment is so critical because you need to know the baseline, especially if you're dealing with a critical patient, okay? So you have to know what the baseline is. There are three subcategories, as I said. One is eye opening. Essentially, are they opening your eyes? Are they awake? Or do you need to rub their sternum a little bit? And I know it sounds terrible, painful stimulation, but you got to cause a little discomfort to people to see how they respond and how much pain, for lack of a better term, have you caused them to get that response. Do you need to rub their eyes rub their sternum, pinch their sternocleidomastoid muscle a little bit, nail bed pressure, or are you doing all this and not getting any response? So you can see on opposite ends of the spectrum. The motor response, are they following commands? When you say squeeze my finger, are they squeezing your finger? If you're rubbing their sternum or are they sort of batting the hand away, that would be called localizing pain. And I think as attorneys, you know, you may not truly understand all of these subsets. And if you do, that's fantastic. But like localizing pain, what that means is if you're pinching somebody's muscle or giving them nail bed pressure, they're reaching for your hand purposefully to get it away because you're hurting them. Or are you doing that to them and putting some nail bed pressure and they're just moving their hands erratically? Okay. Or are you doing all this and they're not moving at all? All right. These are important findings. Verbal response, and this is an important one, and you're going to understand why in a second. Are they speaking with you? Are they oriented? Do they know what's going on? Or are they a little confused? Now, your baseline demented patient, grandma who's 90 years old, who doesn't know where she is. She knows your name and that's about it. She thinks the year's 1924. She's never going to be 15. Her baseline score, as long as everything else is normal, but she's just confused, would be 14. So seeing a score of 14 may be that baseline for that patient. So that's the starting point. Are they saying anything? Or are they not talking at all? All right. These are the three subset categories. And simply by looking at someone, if their eyes are open, if they're talking to you, they know what's going on, and they're following your commands. If you say raise your right arm and they do that, they have a 15. It's something that can be done very quickly. All right. However, this can be done very incorrectly sometimes. When you're reviewing a medical record, also, though, if you see something with a T, you might see a score with a T. You're never going to hear, you're never going to see a 15T, because what the T means is tube. So if it's a 3T, that says to me the patient is intubated and they're probably very sedated. They're not responding. They're not opening their eyes to stimuli. They're either completely in a medical coma, or they're just in a coma or something like that. You can have scores of 7T, et cetera, but the T is there to delineate that we can't assess that verbal response. I don't know if they could talk to me and be oriented because they have a tube down their throat and they can't talk. Okay. That's another thing to look for. If you see a 3T and then put something like they're responding verbally, then that's incorrect also. You can actually be dead. And this number three is very important. You can be dead and have a score of 3. If you're not opening your eyes, you're not responding to pain, and you're not saying anything, you could be dead. All right. I have seen for my own eyes more than one occasion scores of 0. You can't have a 0. Okay. And what that says as a reviewer of a medical record is, wow, if they can't like even assess this patient's neurological status, what's going on here? You know, like how are they assessing this patient? You know, how do they know that his brain bleed wasn't getting worse, or whatever, his stroke wasn't getting worse? So basically, I use a Glasgow Coma Score because it's something that everybody should know how to do. And it can be done so incorrectly sometimes that it can be very detrimental to a patient. And I use it again for, remember, what do the nurses do about it? And we're skipping ahead of assessment, but if you're not assessing it properly, they're not going to get treated properly. And it's a crucial, crucial assessment. For instance, a good rule of thumb for nurses and providers is if a Glasgow Coma score drops 2 points, you're going to immediately call the physician, all right, or the neurosurgeon or something, all right? Some physicians want you to call them. Some trauma docs want you to call them if it drops by 1 point. And again, we do what the doctor says. But let me just explain. It could drop by 1 point because they might have their eyes open spontaneously, but then they're being given morphine or Dilaudid or some type of sedative, and they'd only open their eyes to speech, which would drop their score 1 point. Very easily explainable. Doesn't mean they're deteriorating or need to go to the OR right away. But a decrease in 2 points is a good rule of thumb where a physician should be called. But if a nurse does not, or a physician or a provider, somebody doesn't do that assessment properly in the first place, you're not going to have a good baseline and you're not going to know where to go. Another thing, and this is why I say you always need someone to interpret the medical record, or nurse to sort of temper what you're seeing in the record with what really happens. There's a caveat, a saying out there, intubate at 8. If the Glasgow Coma score is below 8, you need to intubate. I don't say jokingly, because it's very serious if a patient has that low score. But essentially, it means at that point, they're probably not protecting their airway. They're probably going to need intubated because they're mentally not capable of protecting their airway. Now, however, I've had patients with the Glasgow Coma score of 7. And that's their baseline because they've had cerebral palsy. They have had multiple strokes and can't move. They can't talk, but they're protecting their airway. They have a baseline medical condition that is making their Glasgow Coma score very low because of the scoring categories, but they don't need to be intubated. This is why I always say, as a nurse reviewer, what I'm doing as a legal nurse is looking at the medical record, through an interpretive eye. I'm looking at it and saying, okay, I know this is what it says, but this is what may or may not have happened. And this is what it says, and this is what didn't happen, et cetera, et cetera. I'm looking at it saying, did they properly assess the patient? Did they properly do these risk score tools? And again, back to the intubate at 8. Did they really need to intubate because the Glasgow was 7? Or no, the patient was stable and that was their baseline. So basically, to sum it all up, and I appreciate you listening, the assessment is the first step in prudent and reasonable patient care. Assessing a patient properly, timely, and correctly is what a reasonable and prudent practitioner would do in the same or similar circumstances. So it is the standard of practice, and it drives the standard of care for all practitioners. So with that said, I want to thank you so much for listening to one of our very inaugural infocasts. And if you do need further information, please, please, please feel free to call our offices at 814-515-2926. Again, 814-515-2926. Or you can visit our website at gonsmangroupllnc.com. That's L as in Larry, N as in Nancy, C as in Charlie, gonsmangroupllnc.com. You can simply Google Gonsman Group and we will come up. We'll pop right up there. And Gonsman is G-O-N-S as in Sam, M-A-N. So Gonsman Group. So, and again, please feel free as our infocast move on, if you are listening to the pressure ulcer series, but you wanted to hear more about the assessment part, you can feel free to refer back to our website. Always call us if you have any requests for any infocast that you would like to hear. Please get us in touch with us, and I'd be happy to put one together. Or if you have something you want to contribute to an infocast and you want to be interviewed on one of our infocasts, please also feel free to contact our offices. But until next Wednesday, or until the next Wednesday, I'll be putting a new infocast out every other Wednesday. The next one will be on diagnosing and care planning. And that one will be a little bit shorter, so you won't have to sit in your car, as I'm sure you're anxiously sitting there listening to the infocast. I want everyone to have a great day. And again, thank you for taking the time to listen.